Court, Mosquito Boy is not reconvened.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC12984, State in FOA. Arguing for the petitioner, Susan L. Arnett. Arguing for the respondent, Sonia P. McCullen. Argument on the merits.
Okay, good morning, Ms. Arnett and Ms. McCullen. Are you both ready to proceed today?
Yes.
All right, and we'll give you a warning with 7 minutes to go, Ms. Arnett. I guess you wanted that time for rebuttal, and Ms. McCullen will give you a warning with 10 minutes to go in your argument. Please proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, Deputy Public Defender Susan Arnett on behalf of Petitioner Defendant Appellant To'e Nofoa, Chief Justice Recton Wald and Associate Justices. With the court's permission, I'll dispense with a detailed rendition of the facts, but offer the following summary to frame the questions that are before the court. The alleged incident of kidnapping and terroristic threatening occurred on September 11, 2008. There was a preliminary hearing in that case held on September 19, 2008, at which the complaining witness, Royal Kalkani, testified. The defendant was charged with kidnapping and terroristic threatening by complaint filed in the First Circuit Court on September 24, 2008, as a result of probable cause having been determined at the preliminary hearing. March 17, 2009, Ms. Kalkani dies as a result of wounds from gunshot. The defendant is charged with her murder, and he is acquitted at trial on November 23, 2011. He is then tried for the kidnapping terroristic threatening that allegedly occurred in September of 2008 in July of 2012. And on July 23, 2012, he is convicted of kidnapping and of the lesser included offense of terroristic threatening in the second degree. Before this court are four questions presented in the application for writ of certiorari seeking review of the Intermediate Court of Appeals summary disposition order entered January 31, 2014. The questions presented are whether the ICA gravely erred in holding that the preliminary hearing provided NOFOA with a constitutionally adequate opportunity to effectively cross-examine the complaining witness, even though the defense had received no discovery prior to the preliminary hearing. Secondly, whether the ICA gravely erred in holding that it was not an abuse of discretion by the trial court to submit the recording of the complaining witness's preliminary hearing testimony to the jury during deliberations where the testimony of other witnesses was not similarly made available to the jury. Third, whether the ICA gravely erred in holding that the trial court properly admitted the complaining witness's 911 call where her statements were the product of reflective thought, were testimonial, and the call contained other inadmissible hearsay that the court refused to redact. And finally, whether the ICA gravely erred in rejecting defendant's claim of judicial bias, where the trial court interjected itself into the trial as an advocate on behalf of the prosecution by sua sponte objecting to Nofoa's closing argument and proceeding with the drastic and extremely prejudicial remedy of permitting the state to tell the jury in rebuttal closing that the complaining witness was unavailable at trial because she was dead.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Ms. Arnett, but on that point, could you provide some guidance as to the standard of review that would be applied in determining the judicial bias issue? In other words, if there is error, is this to be reviewed as a harmless error matter, or is it a fundamental right requiring a different level of review?
Our position is that under any standard of review, it cannot stand. The error here has to do with the fact that the state created this situation. The state invited the testimony by the defendant that it then complained of. Over a three-page span of cross-examination of the defendant by the prosecutor says to him, so you said you panicked. Those were a word the defendant had used. You were angry, right? No, I was scared. You gently put her in the car, not angrily, not violently. You were trying to close the door on her hands. No. You were talking calmly like now. You're not angry anymore then, right? No, I wasn't angry. You're not angry at Royal anymore. There's no audible response in the transcript.
I understand you're addressing the behavior of the prosecutor, but you're doing that in relation to your contention that there is error based on judicial bias?
Yes.
Why does it have to be analyzed under a judicial bias, or are we talking about the defendant's constitutional right to a fair trial?
Well, all of this has to do with the defendant's constitutional right to a fair trial, and the first being that there was no ability to confront the witness against him, Royal Kokani. The preliminary hearing cross-examination can in no way equal the thorough and fair and effective cross-examination that is required at trial. It's a completely different animal.
It was my understanding that we're talking about your discussion of judicial bias in the court ordering the prosecutor to inform the jury. So in that regard, is there another way to take a look at the fact that to analyze the fact that the jury was allowed to hear a fact that was not in evidence?
The problem,
Besides judicial bias, is
that the prosecutor essentially poked at the witness and drew a response that the prosecutor liked.
I thought this occurred during the final argument.
But this ties into that. Then, so he got that answer, you can ask Royal. And then he tried to make something of it, even though the court was trying to call him back. Then in the state's closing argument.
In fact, right after it occurred, didn't the prosecutor respond by saying the door was open?
Yes.
Right.
Yes. The prosecutor opened that door. And then in closing, he tried to use that information that he had developed in the cross-examination of Mr. Nofoa. And he said, now he's talking to the jury, and he's talking about the defendant's account of things. That just doesn't make sense at all. If he's not angry at her, what does it mean? You know, there's different versions, but she said in her testimony what was overhead. So when you talk about credibility, you have to ask yourself.
Did you allege prosecutorial misconduct? You alleged judicial bias, not prosecutorial misconduct.
Exactly, but the point is that.
In terms of the trial judge. A trial judge could sometimes err in the context of thinking he or she is enforcing his or her rulings in limine. Why aren't we analyzing this under an abuse of discretion standard?
Our contention is that it is abuse of discretion, but the point is that the state opened the door. The state then argued in closing what the defendant had said about asking Royal, and then when the defense counsel got up to respond to the state's argument, that's when the defense counsel was jumped on by the court, and he said, everything he said was, he says, okay, you don't have Royal in front of you. You have the defendant. He was questioned by Mr. Arscato. So you see him in the courtroom. You do have that opportunity to judge credibility. But as to the complainant, you've got to now, because she's not here, you've got to weigh what she said against the rest of the information that you've gotten in this trial. And it doesn't add up. And then he complains about that there's no injuries to match what she says happened to her. And other information like that.
Excuse me, Ms. Arnett, and the trial court seemed to think that that had opened the door to allowing or requiring the remedy that the court ultimately provided. Did that open the door to any remedy or certainly to the remedy that was ultimately adopted by the court?
It is our position that the door was already opened by the prosecutor in the prosecutor's closing argument, because the prosecutor talked about how you could judge the defendant's credibility, and the prosecutor said, she's not available. The prosecutor said that in closing argument. So the prosecutor was highlighting the fact that one party that they're listening to was present, one party that they're listening to was not. So in response to that argument, the defense says that we have to ask at this point if what she's saying, Royal is saying, is true. Why does absolutely nothing back up her story? Not a single witness, not a single scrap of evidence. Goes on to say the reason it doesn't back her up is because she's not telling the truth. But you heard the defendant when he testified, when he responded to the prosecutor's questions, and he told you what happened. So what do we know about Royal and her credibility? And then he gives some factual information that they know about her. And then he says this. This is the crucial paragraph. Okay, because you don't know anything about her and her credibility, the only thing that you can do to judge her credibility is to compare her story to any other evidence presented at the trial. That's the only thing you can do because you didn't get to see here like you did with Toy.
Would you have a problem with a ruling if we were to find that there was, that the judge abused his discretion in creating a correction based on evidence that's not in the record? Would you have a problem with such a ruling?
No. But our point is simply that if you look at what happened in this case, there's no way to look at it other than judicial bias in the way that the court dealt with this. Number one.
Counsel, suppose the judge mishears it, okay? The judge thought, well, first of all, my understanding is the only thing the judge actually banned was an explanation for unavailability. First of all, is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, so that's the only thing. And the defense attorney never tried to give an explanation of unavailability, why she wasn't there. Let me finish.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
So let's assume the judge mishears something and tries to correct it. I'm not sure why that's judicial bias. I think the characterization is what, there may be a problem, but I don't think that judicial bias may have been the proper.
Does the record reflect that the judge knew what the prosecutor argued in the closing argument? Does the record reflect that the judge had actually known that that's what the prosecutor had argued?
I think we have to presume that as the judge was sitting there and it's his job to weigh in, and if there was an objection, he would need to know what had just been said, that he was listening intently to the closing argument of both counsel. The reason that we say that it rises to the level of judicial bias is because immediately, first of all, it's just that one sentence. You didn't hear from her. He jumps in. Now, if he was jumping in his role as the arbiter in the courtroom and saying, hey, don't get close to what I've ruled you can't do, that would have been fine. But he doesn't do that. He says, you've opened the door, and the solution is that the prosecutor gets to tell them that she's deceased.
Ms.
He immediately goes to the most extreme remedy he can come up with.
And Ms. Arnett, did it appear that the judge was following the argument of the prosecutor when he said, I cannot just sit idly by and say, well, you never object. So he's sleeping at the wheel.
Well,
okay, what am I supposed to do? How do you interpret
that
statement?
As he was listening to the argument of both parties, and he noted that the prosecutor had not objected when the court stepped in. And then when the court stepped in and suggested this ultimate extreme remedy, the defense said, wait a second, there's way more remedies to consider before you reach that one. Among them is that you can simply strike my last sentence and instruct the jury to disregard it. And then the court, again, indicating what we believe is a sign of bias, said, if I do that, I will strike your entire closing argument. That was the court's response to that suggestion. So there was never a halfway point. There was never a measured set of responses to be considered. It was always the most extreme. And the court did not say, I'll tell the jury. The court, the neutral party in the room, will tell the jury what I think they're now entitled to be told. He said the prosecutor could tell them. And he didn't give a cautionary instruction at that time, which we don't believe would have cured the problem anyway, but he didn't say to the jury, this is only being told to you to explain her absence. You may not consider it in any other way. And it doesn't matter what he may have said at other times during the trial. When you're about to say to the jury what the prosecutor then got up and said, the reason Royal Kalkane is not here is because she's dead. The impact of that startling revelation at the rebuttal closing of the state was so prejudicial to the defense. And I want to segue now into another one of our arguments, which is the admission of the recording of the complaining witness's preliminary hearing testimony to the jury.
Actually, could I direct you to the preliminary, the whole issue of the preliminary hearing testimony, I think would be one I wanted to ask you about. And I guess my question is, are you suggesting that there can never be circumstances in which preliminary hearing testimony is admissible unless discovery is provided? Is it a blanket rule, or should we be looking at the actual discovery that was at issue and trying to determine whether there was prejudice as a result of the defense not having it?
We believe it is a blanket rule. We believe that there should be a per se finding that preliminary hearing testimony may not be used in lieu of a witness at trial. And that is because not only the lack of discovery, but the lack of ability to do anything with that discovery. In this case, Welko County had given four statements. She had the 911 call, she had her HPD 252 statement, she had the statement that she had given to Detective Takaki recorded, and she had her preliminary hearing testimony. And there were major inconsistencies among those. In the 911 call, she never mentions a gun. She's summoning the police. She's
Are you saying that there would never be any situation, let's say that we have a complaining witness or a witness who's about to die, and the defendant is out on bail, preliminary hearing is within 30 days, the state provides all the discovery potentially available, and everyone's on notice. You have 29 days to prep for this preliminary hearing, and you will be given a full and fair opportunity to conduct cross-examination during the preliminary hearing. You still say we should have a blanket rule saying preliminary hearing testimony will never be admissible.
We do say that, but and we agree that you can fashion an example which would seem to be the extreme that should allow it.
Let me give you a not-so-extreme example. Why don't we take any typical UCPB where the only thing the owner may testify is lack of permission. I didn't give the defendant permission. And that's the only statement they are called to make on. And then the person is shipped off for a few years to Iraq or wherever. And that's it. And there's adequate discovery. That's not sufficient.
The problem with that is, and it would have to be fashioned so carefully, and it would have to be so clear, that in light of this court's ruling in Toledo v. Lamb, the burden is on the state have provided the discovery if they want to use it later at trial. But here's the problem. We're talking about this case. And in this case, not only was there no opportunity to cross-examine her about the inconsistencies among her statements, the fact that some referred to a gun, some did not. Some never described any joggers in the area. Her preliminary hearing testimony said there was one jogger. Her recorded statement to Detective Takaki said there were three sets of joggers at various times. And she has those joggers coming in after he got angry, after he got upset, after he was being aggressive and had grabbed her. She says in some statements there was a driver there, in others she does not.
I think the specific question, though, that originated with the Chief Justice and Justice McKenna is the absolute rule that you're advocating, because the jurisdictions that you rely upon that are cited in your brief, almost every one of them, preliminary hearing is far more restricted than what Toledo versus Lamb gives one.
The problem, Mr. Associate Justice, is that in this case, there was no it's not just a matter of receiving the discovery. And in Associate Justice McKenna's example, the defendant is out of custody. That is not usually the case at preliminary hearing. The defendant is in custody. So you're asking the defense to essentially violate the defendant's constitutional rights to the timed disposition of these matters by extending the time for the preliminary hearing so that the defendants can get up to speed, but it ignores the fact that there's two scenes that need to be visited. One needs to see whether the joggers were within hailing distance or exactly how.
We're not discussing this case. We're just discussing the general rule.
Well,
that should be promulgated.
I understand that you may see our position as extreme. We believe our position is merited under Crawford. That the right to confrontation, that is denied when there hasn't been a full and thorough cross-examination at the preliminary hearing. And in any case, perhaps you want to make a distinction that it can only be a C felony if you want to use the example of a UCPB or something like that. But
well, isn't the distinction based primarily on whether there's an adequate opportunity to confront the witness?
Yes, that is the distinction in a number of the cases, and clearly here there was not.
And usually that's a somewhat fact-driven analysis, right? And we have Toledo
versus... In addition to the different statements she made and the inconsistencies among them, she essentially gives an hour and 30 minutes, roughly, maybe an hour and 20 minutes, for the time that it took to get from Ko'olina to where they ended up in Haleiwa. She claims that he was driving fast all of that time, and there were no stoplights. They had green lights all the way. That trip doesn't take an hour and 20 or 30 minutes. So there was no opportunity to cross-examine her about the time period that she describes and why it doesn't add up.
But Ms. Arnett, may I ask a question about the statements? Were they not all admitted into evidence at trial, and so didn't the defense at least have the opportunity to argue them at trial, and in fact, did it argue the inconsistency?
The 911 call came in, and the
252 came in,
yeah.
And the tape-recorded statement came in, I believe,
but
as well.
But the problem is,
so they all came in.
Chief Justice, there's a difference between the jury seeing something on paper and having the opportunity to watch someone either justify or rationalize or explain why there are major inconsistencies among statements.
Well, wait a minute. We know why she's not there. So how, I mean, yeah, there's a difference, but you can't ding the prosecution for her not being there at the trial.
And you can't blame the defendant for her not being there at trial.
So you're saying they shouldn't have been the written statements at trial?
No, I'm saying that that doesn't take the place of thorough cross-examination at the preliminary hearing. And it's the recording of the preliminary hearing that went into the jury deliberation room that got the emphasis, got treated differently than all other testimony, and we believe was in line with our claim that if by the end of the trial and closing argument the judicial bias was shown.
Was there a written statement, complaining witnesses' written statement received in evidence?
I don't recall that the 252 came in as evidence. The problem is simply this.
I think it did. I'm just looking at the exhibit list, and I hope I'm not misinterpreting it, but it says HPD 252 of Royal Kalkani admitted into evidence on 625, transcript of recorded interview admitted into evidence on 625, and report of I think it was the officer who interviewed her, Officer Clownon, admitted into evidence.
Those were not argued in closing.
But isn't that kind of the point? I mean, if there were such profound discrepancies, why wouldn't defense counsel argue them in closing?
But there were profound discrepancies.
Well, why wouldn't they argue?
That's factually correct.
Why wouldn't he argue? Why didn't defense counsel argue them? In other words, if I'm trying to get a read on the prejudice that was suffered here. The statements are in evidence, and defense counsel doesn't argue.
Excuse me. Maybe that 625 is the evidence for the motion in limine.
And the Rule 104 hearing.
Oh, yes.
So you don't think it was in a trial?
Yes, that's
okay.
Correct. And
although the issue of the gun was at trial,
yes.
And the fact that the gun was mentioned
in the
materials in the 911 tape that was not available at the preliminary hearing did serve as a basis for focused discussion during the course
of
the closing
one
argument.
Discrepancy, but there was no opportunity to cross-examine the complaining witness about the inconsistencies of these statements, about the scene at Coalina, about where the joggers were in relation. She even says in one of her statements, in her statement to Detective Kaki, I could have yelled, but I didn't. About the driver of the truck, why she didn't seek help from the driver of the truck as they were leaving, because she has her door open as he's going around to his side of the car. She says it wasn't until he gets in his side of the car and reaches across her and closes the door. That's when the door is closed. So it would appear to be opportunity for her to jump out at that point and hail that driver of the truck. Again, regarding the timeline, that doesn't add up as well.
Does it matter at all? And the trial court had pointed out that there was no request for a continuance or a demand by the defense for these items. In your view, should that matter at all or not?
No, because the defense did not need a continuance of the preliminary hearing. The purpose of the preliminary hearing was to establish probable cause. And the defense had adequate information to defend against the probable cause, simply to challenge with questions whether the state could establish probable cause to the satisfaction of the district court judge. That was the purpose of the preliminary hearing. That was what the questions asked by preliminary hearing defense counsel went to. That they were not trying to develop trial testimony to be used later. And indeed, you either make the prelim a mini trial, and you have a situation where the preliminary hearing will extend weeks, if not months, while all of this discovery is done. If the defendant tells us in the back that he has three witnesses who can place him somewhere else or who can describe what happened, then we have to try to go find them in order to render effective representation, if that's what's going to be required of the defense at a preliminary hearing. And our position is that's not what a preliminary is for. That's not our procedural system. And the state should not be allowed to not disclose what is in their possession and then say later, so you didn't get full and thorough cross-examination, that we're going to claim you did, but we want to use the testimony now. And the problem is that even Rule 16, the discovery rule under the Hawaii Rules of Penal Procedure, does not apply at the preliminary hearing stage. The rules of evidence do not apply at the preliminary hearing stage.
But so if your argument is that they didn't get discovery, then if discovery is given, then why shouldn't the preliminary hearing testimony be allowed?
Because the problem is how you determine that discovery is given. And the examples that we gave in this case are that it wouldn't have been a matter of simply giving the statements. They would have had to have been checked out. One witness is identified in the JDPC, supplied to that, that's the one document the defense counsel had at prelim, the judicial determination of probable cause. And that only refers to one witness. In fact, there were two witnesses at the Haleiwa gas station. We don't know if there were more.
You know, as a matter of practicality, you can argue theoretically that you wanted it would have to be a mini trial or whatever to be fair if you're going to be using it. But as a matter of fact, the defense doesn't want to give away too much by asking too many detailed questions that might provide a defense that gives the prosecution notice of what the defense is going to be at trial. Isn't that true, too?
That's true at a probable cause hearing. But if the defense is going to be told that it will count against you, you didn't ask those questions, you didn't ask for more discovery, but this can be used at trial, and too bad.
I mean, and they do know that, right? At
no.
At a preliminary hearing, you don't think a defense attorney at a preliminary hearing doesn't know that that testimony could be used at trial?
Could be used, but the issue is whether there's a full and thorough, fair cross-examination. And what the defense counsel is aware of is if I have no discovery, none whatsoever, in a Class A felony kidnapping charge where the defendant is facing 20 years, I'm not having a full and thorough cross-examination.
And Ms. Arnett,
of this witness.
Wasn't that part of the issue in Toledo versus Lamb when Justice Padgett made the point when the case was sent back to the trial court that it would be a good idea to produce the statement that the defense counsel was attempting to cross-examine the witness about? Wasn't the point of the remand with that kind of message that there does need to be a concern about whether there's an adequate opportunity for cross-examination at the preliminary hearing stage?
That was the overall question within which the court was determining Toledo v. Lamb, although in that case it dealt with the defendant's statement, and that was what was at issue about whether it would be handed over or not. But under Crawford and the cases that have come from Crawford, both nationally and in Hawaii, the right to confrontation is significantly more protected at this point, and that, you know, Toledo was decided even before that, even though it stands for that same proposition.
Could I ask perhaps for your help on the issue of whether the playing of the CD of the preliminary hearing testimony was proper?
We didn't specifically raise that as an issue. We raised the admission of the recording to the jury, the presentation of the recording to the jury, and the highlighting of that testimony. I would say in practice, the court does often allow the actual recording, and in this case, allowed the jury to follow along on a transcript, which was then collected from the jury afterwards. So it was the recording that went into evidence rather than the transcript. But our complaint is the fact that it was allowed in any form, because it was not a full and thorough cross-examination by the defense, because of actions the state took in not providing discovery, and that was exacerbated by allowing the jury to have only it in the jury room with them, and particularly in light of the fact that the jury had just learned that this witness was dead. So now they're listening to a voice of a person when she was living, whom they now know not to be living, and they don't know when she died, of course they weren't told that, and of course they weren't told how, but even unconscious or unspoken thoughts about this may be one of the last things that times her voice was heard, highlights and makes prejudicial that in the jury room. I do want to mention that regarding the closing arguments, and I know the court is very concerned with the judicial bias issue, that we believe we were complying with Rule 19.29 of HOJIC, the Hawaii Jury Instructions, which talk about what the jury may consider in weighing evidence. And it talks about you may consider the witness's appearance and demeanor, manner of testifying, candor, frankness, lack thereof, temper, feeling, or bias, probability or improbability of the witness's testimony, whether it's supported or contradicted by other evidence. And our position is that that's exactly what the defense was doing in its closing argument, was applying that rule in argument in response to what the state had done, but I'm going to stop talking because I think I only have a couple minutes.
Thank you very much, Ms. Arnett. Now we'll hear from Ms. McCullen.
May it please the court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Sonia McCullen on behalf of the state of Hawaii. To address the three issues discussed here, the defendant's right to confrontation was not violated. The circuit court did not abuse its discretion in sending the CD with all the other exhibits, and the record here does not show judicial bias. Starting with the judicial bias issue, the defendant uses the term judicial bias, but instead, Hawaii law, it doesn't appear applicable here. Hawaii law explains that judicial bias requires a showing that the ruling stemmed from marked personal feelings on both sides, inflicting lingering personal stings on the judge. And there's no evidence of that here. Instead, it appears that the defendant would be arguing more of an error or abuse of discretion. Yes.
Can it be proper for a judge to order the prosecutor to state something on the record, to argue something to the jury that wasn't evidence in the trial?
I understand that that's not usual, and the prosecution's closing arguments, not evidence, and basically the judge in this case told the prosecutor to tell the jury something, and that wasn't in evidence, and his closing argument wouldn't be evidence. Under Padilla, somewhat analogous, because there was a negative inference raised as to the unavailability in Padilla, and the Supreme Court held that the prosecutors telling the jury why it couldn't bring that witness in was, or the prosecutor was entitled to do that. So the prosecutor in that case did deliver that information. But even if it was abuse for the court here, or this court, or the circuit court, to allow the prosecutor to give that information to the jury instead of the court itself, it would be harmless because based on the testimonies of McNeil and Garcia, they both have very similar testimonies as to what they saw at the gas station, that the defendant grabbed her, picked her up, carried her to the car, shoved her in the car, slamming the door in her hands and feet while she's screaming, "Help me."
That would all go to the kidnapping. What about the terroristic threatening?
Yeah, without the preliminary hearing testimony, we couldn't support the terroristic threatening charge.
And the jury jury didn't actually accept that part of the testimony because they rejected the TT1, which involved the use of the firearm, and found the defendant guilty of TT2, which doesn't require it. So they actually rejected part of
the firearm, yes.
Well, part of the testimony. So to argue harmlessness, I think one has to accept the fact that at least part of the testimony that came through the preliminary hearing transcript wasn't.
Yeah, what the state is saying is even without the preliminary hearing testimony, there's sufficient evidence to support the jury's conclusion for the kidnapping.
Is sufficient evidence our standard? I mean, if we find an error here, isn't it harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, not a substantial evidence?
So there's overwhelming evidence to show that defendant wasn't substantial rights weren't affected.
Now, when you say harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, I'm not quite clear what error you're referring to, because are you conceding under that analysis that there was an error by the court? And if so, are you saying it was error but it didn't demonstrate judicial bias and therefore it has to be judged under a different standard? The reason I ask that is because isn't it true that if judicial bias is found, we don't get to harmless error? It's just a fundamental right to a fair trial, to have an impartial judge or trier of the fact, and once that right's been violated, then you don't consider whether it's harmless error because it's a fundamental error that would require a reversal.
You are correct. When looking at the application, that argument is somewhat confusing because they use the terms like judicial bias. But I don't, and if we are analyzing it based on judicial bias and this court does find bias, it is a structural error. It is reversed. There's no harmless analysis.
I'm sorry, in the State versus Silva case, I know you were talking about your thoughts that perhaps judicial bias must be shown by a marked personal bias. But in Silva, that's where the court did a lot of questioning of the witness, and the court found because of the nature of the questioning, the court took over the role of the prosecutor. And in this case, in looking at the facts and considering whether the court took over the role of the prosecutor, it was true at a certain point that the court found that the prosecutor wasn't acting in a manner that I guess you could say was diligent. That's the sort of comment that was made, right? And then the court found that it had to take over. So how would that not mean he was taking over the role of the prosecutor?
Well, okay. What the argument does is kind of conflate these different rights. First, judicial bias is in there. Also, what you're discussing with the role of the prosecutor goes to his right to an impartial judge, so that's in there too. And then there's kind of the whole error, he abuses discretion. So all that's being conflated in one argument. If we separate it out and we address judicial bias, the standard of review is de novo, and it would be structural error. And if we go down to the impartial tribunal part, that also de novo, structural error, and that's where the role of the prosecutor comes in.
That's not a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard?
I understood it to be structural.
Okay.
But we'll take harmless. The circuit court in this case did not, I don't think, assumed the role of the prosecutor. According to Hawaii case law, it says the trial judge takes on the role of the prosecutor when he or she conducts a rigorous, persistent, and extensive interrogation of a witness, eliciting testimony which tends to discredit the theory of the defense with questions normally identified with a prosecutor. And in the case Justice Wilson is discussing, the court asked something like 110 questions. That didn't happen here.
What is the standard of review for judicial notice? Judicial notice of adjudicative fact.
Judicial notice for an adjudicative.
Could this be analyzed under judicial notice? That's just my question. I'm throwing it out there.
Yeah, I'm not prepared to discuss that.
Can I ask you to address a point that Ms. Arnett made, which is that viewed in the context of the prosecutor's closing argument, the comment that the defense counsel made that caused the reaction from the circuit court judge in fact didn't cross any line. It didn't go into an area of closing argument that in any way violated the motion in limine. In other words, viewed against the context of what the prosecution had argued, the argument made here by the defense was the only thing you can do because you didn't get to see her, like you did with him, is to compare it to the other evidence in the case. Why is that an improper argument?
Well, it's improper because the defense took it one step further. It didn't just reiterate the instructions that the court gave to the jury that she's unavailable. What the defense said was, here, you got to see the defendant. You got to see and hear him testify, so the inference is you should believe him. And then went on to say, you couldn't see her or hear her like you did the defendant.
Isn't that what unavailability is by definition? You didn't get to see. The judge had already told him they couldn't speculate on the reason, and that I thought the only thing prohibited was the reason. I don't think defense counsel referenced the reason.
Defense counsel didn't reference the reason why she was unavailable, but what happened was there was that inference that she shouldn't be found credible because you didn't get to see her, but but he should be found credible because you got to see. So he's taking it kind of one step further. He's going beyond just...
In that regard, can you help me about why it would be inappropriate to say something about her being unavailable, given the fact that during the opening statement of the prosecutor, he told the jury, so don't be fooled with a ploy like that. What he's really saying is she's not unavailable. I mean, the prosecutor, it sounded like the prosecutor raised the issue of availability.
The prosecutor, I believe that quote you're taking from is when, and correct me if I'm wrong, is when he was referencing the defendant's statement that you should ask Royal. Is that correct?
Yes, there was a discussion about the conversation that had been generated by the prosecutor during the trial, where the prosecutor went into a line of questioning in which he started discussing the unavailability of the witness. So I'm not sure that necessarily makes the point about how it was inappropriate for the defense counsel to address the issue.
Well, at that point, when the prosecutor raised unavailability, what the prosecutor's point in that statement or those groups of statements was that a defendant's not credible because, look, he didn't follow the judge's instructions. We were all told she's unavailable and shouldn't speculate, but what does he do? He says, you should ask her. And so that's the prosecutor technically just restated the court's instruction and referenced evidence in the record.
Didn't the prosecutor start all of that in the, when the prosecutor during cross-examination said something like, are you still mad at her or something? That was...
Okay, the prosecutor in that line of questioning was questioning defendant on the events that took place. He was going through the events that took place. And then he asked, if I recall correctly, he asked the defendant, so about Garcia, telling him to stop. And he asked if he was saying it in an angry voice. And he said, no, it was calm or something like that. And the prosecutor said, that appeals to you. And he goes, yeah, so you're not angry anymore. And then he went on, he took it somewhere else. The defendant took the line of questioning somewhere else and said, you should ask Royal.
No, actually, it was the defendant said, you're not, no, I wasn't angry. And the prosecutor asked, you are not angry at the complaining witness anymore? And there was no response, and he asked again, you are not angry at CW anymore either? And that's when he finally said, you can ask her.
But that's not it. That question's not out of line. That question's not improper. He's asking the defendant what is his, I guess, emotional or mental state at the time, whether he's angry or not. And the defense...
Oh, you're going to argue that? That there wasn't an attempt to elicit... the woman isn't alive anymore. And I don't know how that can be a proper question. Didn't it seem like, I mean, that he was baiting him?
Oh, I didn't get that when I read it. I'm sorry.
To say, you're not mad at her when she's dead. Why would you ask somebody if they're mad at somebody knowing that she's dead?
Well, the defendant testified that he was mad at her when they got to the gas station.
But he was talking about at the time of the trial, right? Whether he's still mad at her.
Yes. Well, no.
Oh, is that what? Oh,
that's what I interpreted the question to be, because they're at the gas station and he's asking him.
I understand. I'm sorry. Okay, I thought it was at the time of trial.
That wasn't how I interpreted the question.
Okay, I'm sure I misinterpreted.
Well, if we could, I would like to ask you a bit about the preliminary hearing issue. And we heard from Ms. Arnett that the defense's position is there should be a blanket rule against admitting preliminary hearing testimony. What's the state's position with regard to that? And then I'd also like you to address the question of what prejudice resulted to the defendant here by not having the discovery, because Ms. Arnett cited a number of examples of inconsistencies between the statements and I guess the preliminary hearing testimony that she said the defense should have had the opportunity to explore before this testimony should have been admissible. So two-part question, blanket rule And if your answer to that is no blanket rule, what about prejudice?
The state takes the position that there shouldn't be a blanket rule. Crawford's been in existence for 10 years. There hasn't been the parade of horribles that the defense is warning, like mini trials or judicial expense. It hasn't come to that. So the state's position that there shouldn't be a blanket rule, and should this court consider having a blanket rule, the state's position would be it'd be purely prospective because it'd be a new rule, completely different from what's been in effect for decades, and that it shouldn't affect the defendant's conviction in this case. As to question number two, the prejudice. Kilkenny's prior statement was not fatal here in this case. The defendant was given the JDPC. The circuit court
How do you impeach a JDPC? I mean, let's suppose you wanted to cross-examine. Do you have to, I mean, you can't, it's kind of like secondhand. Isn't it true you told a police officer this, and if she says no, that's the end of it? In other words, when you don't have the actual statement, it's pretty hard to cross.
I understand what you're saying, and I think you're correct to an extent, but what Crawford requires, and this court has acknowledged Crawford repeatedly, is it requires unavailability, which is not an issue here, and number two, it requires a prior opportunity to cross-examine.
Well,
Crawford didn't put modifiers on that.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but following up on the Chief Justice's question about possible prejudice, could you provide your view about the issue of the gun that seems to have become relevant in terms of the discovery that was provided after the preliminary hearing, because the gun is not mentioned in the 911 call, and that was information given to the defense after the preliminary hearing. Now, this is a case in which I guess we can concede the gun is pretty important since the TT1 charge was based on the gun, and also naturally, the gun's pretty significant when it comes to determining whether there was a threat, terroristic threatening threat. So if you assume that the defendant was deprived the opportunity to question her about why she didn't mention the 911 call, would that be a significant loss of opportunity to cross-examine?
I thought he did question her about the gun and being in one hand and not the other.
He did. He questioned her about it at the preliminary hearing about the gun, and she mentioned that there was a gun, but then later the defense received a 911 tape in which she didn't say anything about a gun.
The 911 tape itself was very short. She didn't start the call. She came in kind of midway or a little earlier than midway, and she just picked up the phone, but at the same time she's having another conversation with with Garcia, and she's responding just to the operator's questions, and then she kind of said, okay, I'm done. When it came to the license plate number and the operator saying it doesn't show up as an Isuzu, she's kind of like done with the conversation and she moves on.
Well, that sounds
I don't think it was a conversation where the gun would have come up.
All right, well, that sounds like a good explanation for why the gun might not have come up, but I mean, the question is whether defense counsel could have thought of something else, since defense counsel would be in the role of doing a cross-examining. But let's just, again, recognizing this issue of the gun, when you do consider whether there was prejudice as a result of the defense not getting certain discovery in this case, do you factor in the prejudice that would arise from an inference that the jury was allowed to draw that the complaining witness is not there because she's dead? Would that, I mean, there's discussion in the record that that could lead to the inference that she's dead because the defendant killed her. So if that's an inference that you would accept, does that affect the question about the degree to which the preliminary hearing, the lack of evidence at the preliminary hearing would prejudice the defendant?
I don't think I understand that.
When you consider the degree of prejudice that might have arisen in this case, do you just do you look at the evidence as a whole, correct, and the error that might have been committed? And if it was error to allow in evidence that would allow the inference that the defendant may have killed the complaining witness, then wouldn't that mean that you have to be extra cautious about any additional prejudice that might have been introduced through failure to produce evidence at the or discovery for the preliminary hearing?
I think that, well, to try to address the first part of your question regarding the inference, to make the assumption that defendant killed Coke Honey, I think would require three huge jumps on the jury's part. First, they would have to assume or infer an unnatural versus natural death. And the second jump would be that the unnatural death was a result of murder as opposed to something else like injuries from a car accident. And the third jump would be that he did it.
Well, I'm not sure you're aware of the timing, but after the prosecutor was allowed to tell the jury that the complaining witness was dead, the next sentence that the prosecutor used refers to the gun, refers to the fact, starts discussing a gun in the case. So that might have been something that would be a helpful jog to the jury to think that if he had a gun in this case, the complaining witness is dead. The complaining witness died sometime after the preliminary hearing and before the trial.
I still believe that would be a huge assumption to think, or a huge leap for the jury to make, especially in light of the judge's instructions, the limiting instructions by the judge, and the fact that during voir dire, the court and the attorneys were very careful in trying to ensure that the potential jurors didn't have prior knowledge about these cases.
What were the last words that he said to her at the gas station?
The testimonies are different. It something along the lines of, Sole, I'm going to get you, or Sole, this isn't over yet. It was something along those lines.
And you think it's a huge leap to be made? You know, counsel.
To murder? Yes, I do.
Okay. Counsel, you were talking about how Crawford, you felt that Crawford only had to show an opportunity for cross-examination.
Prior opportunity to cross-examine.
But what about California versus Green? I mean, that's still good law, isn't it? Aren't we bound by that? And doesn't it say that?
Crawford cited California as.
Case says the witness has to be subject to full and effective cross-examination. So it doesn't just say opportunity, and it's full and effective.
Well, Crawford examined California, Mancusi, all those cases, Maddox, and that's in that discussion of Crawford. That's where Crawford discusses adequate. And prior to its discussion of all those cases, and following its discussion of all those cases, Crawford doesn't put any modifiers on prior opportunity to cross-examination, and it's holding its prior opportunity to cross-examination. And one of the reasons why it overruled Roberts was because Roberts was subjective. It required all these, the court's consideration of all these factors, which could be manipulated.
So are you arguing then that California versus Green, really, are you arguing that it's Crawford's trumped that case, or are you arguing that, because my understanding was that the two worked together. I didn't think that Crawford was diminishing the standard for cross-examination. Just they were saying opportunity, that's it. You don't need to actually.
Crawford, in discussing, when California v. Green went and made its holding, it also considered that the defendant had counsel, I believe, and it was the same counsel, and that the defendant had testimony was in a judicial proceeding where a recording was made, and that kind of goes more to the Roberts test of indicia of reliability, which is what Crawford was overruling. And so Crawford doesn't require and didn't look at any of those factors that Green used in making its holding. Instead, it just said two things were required, unavailability and prior opportunity to cross-examine. And perhaps if we start putting modifiers, we're going back to a Crawford-like test.
So it doesn't have to be adequate opportunity. So if you cut the person off, you only give them 5 minutes for a cross-examination, that might be okay.
But that didn't happen in this case. The defendant was not cut off. The defendant was able to cross-examine. The state didn't object. The court didn't restrict. Mm-hmm. I believe the cross-examination for one, or the preliminary hearing having only one witness, lasted almost an hour. There doesn't appear to be any kind of overt restrictions or even covert restrictions on the cross-examination itself.
So the absence of information. And, you know, I wonder why the prosecutor didn't just disclose his statements.
I believe that the testimony, or sorry, not the testimony, the interview, because in his application he claims only two...
The transcript wasn't prepared until after the preliminary hearing.
And I don't recall the record.
But the recording might have been available, maybe not the transcription, but that's a different issue.
I guess so, yes.
Can you address also the fact that this recording went into evidence, and what's your view on that? Because the defense is raising that as an error.
I think the cases the defendant relies on are distinguishable, but more importantly, I think that in reviewing the plain language of the rule that it was admitted under prior testimony, the legislature intended not to include the restriction, because when you look at 804B as a whole, 804B1 doesn't have that restrictive language, but 804B6 does have that restrictive language. And so the legislature is presumed to have intentionally excluded that language.
Court has no discretion as to whether or not it lets a jury look at an exhibit.
Sorry, what?
Is it your argument that the court doesn't have discretion about when to admit, when to allow the jury to look at the exhibits admitted in evidence? I mean, for example, guns, dynamite?
The court has discretion. The state's argument is it didn't abuse its discretion because it appears from the plain language of the statute itself that the restriction was excluded by the legislature. And even if
the court has no authority, even when the court says, the court ruled in this case, but it's also unduly unfair, for the CD to go into evidence, to go to the juries, because jurors won't have the transcripts of other witnesses who testified. So it's going to highlight one witness over the other. So the basis for the court ruling had nothing to do with whether the court thought it was prejudicial. The court let it in because it felt that it had to. And I'm asking you, do you believe the court has any discretion that whenever a CD is admitted, or whenever evidence is admitted, the court has to allow it to go to the jury?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the court has the discretion. But it's not an abuse of discretion if the legislature purposely didn't restrict placing that exhibit into the or with the jury.
But the judge didn't exercise discretion. The judge said, first the judge was going to exclude it, and then the judge said, oops, it's in evidence, I have to let it go to the jury.
Well, I believe what I recall is when the judge said under 804B1, it doesn't provide for that restriction like 802.14 does. So that was my recollection of his explanation.
But you understand, or do you agree that the general law around the country is courts have discretion as to whether or not exhibits specifically go to the jury or not?
That is correct.
Ms. McCullen, I want to ask you, is there any limit in the state's view to, or is there any obligation on the prosecution to provide some discovery in the circumstance of a preliminary hearing? In other words, the defense is arguing for a blanket rule, preliminary hearing testimony should never come in. I've asked you about prejudice in this case. You seem to think that there wasn't enough prejudice in this case because of the denial of the discovery, but is there some line or some test that we should be applying to determine, are there cases out there where there might be too much prejudice, or what would be the rule that you would suggest we apply in deciding whether it's an adequate opportunity based on the lack of discovery?
I think Crawford was clear. It said it gave two requirements, unavailability and prior opportunity to cross-examine. I'm not sure if this court decides to make a test or add modifiers like adequate, full, and thorough, which requires discovery, even if this court does do that, I think it was met in this case because defendant did receive the JDPC, and it did have all the similar, it was very similar in content. The circuit court did a thorough job of going through each document and comparing them. Even if this court fashioned some kind of rule, I think we need it in this case.
Okay, now, your time's up, but I'm going to give Ms. Arnett more time as well because we were asking her questions during her time she had reserved. So if you'd like several minutes now to wrap up your argument, or?
I would, actually. In conclusion, the state's position is the right to confrontation was not violated because the defendant did have a prior opportunity to cross-examine, and he actually did. He did receive the JDPC, which had some of the information. It wasn't an abuse of discretion to send the CD to the jury based on the legislative intention to purposely exclude that restriction. As to bias, the state's position is that doesn't apply here. And even if the preliminary hearing testimony was not available or was error to admit, the state's position is there's still sufficient evidence to support the kid, or it wasn't harmless because there's overwhelming evidence to support the kidnapping conviction. Thank you.
Very well, thank you. Ms. Arnett.
Thank you.
Now, how much time does Ms. Arnett have left?
1 minute left.
Okay, well, we'll go for a bit, and then I'll give you a couple minutes to wrap up. Ms. Arnett, thank you.
Very quickly. Having reviewed the standard of review in response to the court's earlier questions, on both the constitutional question of the right to confrontation, it's a de novo review as cited by this court in Kalaola, and as cited by this court in State v. Yap, the review of judicial bias is also a de novo review. The state's reliance on Padilla is not persuasive. Padilla is completely factually distinguishable. In Padilla, it was the defense counsel who caused the unavailability of the witness because the state rested, then realized they hadn't called a witness, asked if the defense would agree to their reopening the case. The defense did not agree, and that's why that witness was not able to testify. Then in closing, the defense counsel said, well, you didn't hear from this witness who was involved in this case, so you've got to conclude that since they didn't call him, the testimony would have been not beneficial to the state. And that's what Padilla was all about, very different than this situation. We are arguing for a per se rule here, but let me step back for a moment and say that even if there is not a per se rule, even if it is a case-by-case determination, this case cannot hold. To suggest that full cross-examination is because you asked a lot of questions, the questions that were asked all dealt with the probable cause issue before the court at the preliminary hearing. That's all it dealt with. And so there's no question that there was an impossibility of the defense challenging the witness's testimony the way it would have been challenged at trial with the inconsistencies. To suggest that the JDPC sufficed is frankly laughable because the JDPC was double hearsay. It was Detective Lee reporting what Officer Clownan reported that Ms. Kalkani told him, or what Detective Takaki reported that the complaining witness had told him, and it was not factually correct because it's the only statement in this case where it says that the complainant said that the defendant asked her to walk him to her car as if he was planning to carry out what happened afterwards. And in fact, she never says that in any of her statements. She says she voluntarily walked to his car. If I could just finish the one thing about the JDPC. There's nothing about joggers in the JDPC. There's nothing about her being in the car with the door open while he went around, about a driver being there from which she might have gotten help, about the claim that he said, let's shoot each other, and about nothing about her trying to jump out and him closing the door on her. So the JDPC was completely unreliable as a source of cross-examination material for Ms. Kalkani at the preliminary hearing. I'm sorry, were you waving?
Are you asking for a new trial?
Yes. Yes, we're asking for a remand and proceedings consistent with the opinion of the court. We contend that it was not a huge leap at all for the jury once they heard that information that indeed was not in evidence that she was dead. Because in the state's closing argument, the state argued you listen to what Royal says, he was going to kill her and himself, and he put the gun to her neck. He had no good intentions for Royal at all. He was there because he wanted her to be fearful that she's going to die. So indeed, the jury was being told in closing argument that he wanted to kill her, that that was his intent that day, the day of the kidnapping incident. And then after they're told the information that she is indeed dead, and that was the word that was used, then the discussion goes into his possession of a gun.
Could you ever see any situation in which a judge would not err in informing a jury that a witness was unavailable because he or she was dead? In other words, couldn't there be a situation where that would just not be prejudicial at all?
Arguably, yes. If a witness had died of cancer, had been hit by a car, or was unavailable for reasons completely unrelated to the case, and in no way that could be blamed on any party, theoretically that might be possible. But
and that would not have been in evidence.
Well, I don't know that you could have done it if it was not in evidence, because it wouldn't have. I'm not sure it would ever have been appropriate if it was not in evidence. I'm saying that it might have been possible for a court to judicially notice a fact like that.
And but in Padilla, the explanation given was not in evidence.
But that was essentially being tied to what the court perceived as wrongdoing on the part of the defense counsel to create a situation and then argue it a different interpretation of the situation that the defense counsel interpreted. We don't have anything like that here. And in fact, what we have in the closing argument, which flows from the cross-examination of Mr. Nofoa by the state, that all the questions, you know, the state now contends that the questions at the end of the towards the end of the cross-examination were not a baiting of Mr. Nofoa. They were just an extension of the earlier questions. But that's not the case if you look at the transcript. All of the questions were past tense. You panicked. You were angry. You put her in the car. You were trying. And then he moves to present tense. You're not angry anymore, right? And the answer is, no, I wasn't angry. The defendant is still trying to stay in the past tense. Question asked again, until the prosecutor gets a response he was looking for.
If we analyze this under State versus Silva, a fair trial standard, is it structural error or is it potentially reviewable under harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
We don't believe it is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. It is a de novo review. The point, it really all continues to come back to Crawford and the right to confrontation. And because there was no right to confrontation, everything about Ms. Kaukani's testimony just becomes heightened and particularly more challenging. And then the reference to her testimony, which both parties make in closing argument, which they're permitted to.
Would it have been error for the trial judge to have a comment or for the judge to have taken? I understand the prejudice, but could a trial judge say the complaining witness is unavailable because the complaining witness has passed away? The cause of death has nothing to do with this case, and you are to take no adverse inference from what I have just said. Would that always be improper?
Yes. Under these kinds of facts, yes. It's the bell you can't unring. You're talking about an incident with a gun, with threats to kill. That's what the jury's going to hear. So to tell them in whatever nicest words one can come up with that she is no longer living is so prejudicial that the prejudice cannot outweigh the manner in which that information is relayed. The other problem with that is that it's to cure the unavailability of the witness or any conclusions the jury might make regarding the unavailability of the witness and the inability then of her to be challenged with her inconsistencies and that sort of thing. And that lies on the state. That lies on the state. The state is the one that has the burden. The state can't meet the burden here. It cannot meet the burden of having fulfilled and given information to the defense to render any kind of full and thorough cross-examination at the preliminary hearing. We didn't get to the excited utterance issue of the 911 call, but I will simply say that even in closing argument, the state stated that she was not in fear at the time that she made the 911 call. That's why she sounds calm and complete sentences and everything's fine. We think that takes it, clearly shows they did not establish a foundation to have it admitted as an excited utterance. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to both of our attorneys today. The court will take this matter under advisement.